All right. I like that music. Another episode of the show. And before we get to my guest, youtube.com/PaulMercurio. I've been posting stuff there. Go check it out and subscribe if you can. And my guest is the chief legal correspondent and host of The Beat with Ari Melber of MSNBC, Ari Melber. And I wanted to have him on because he's got really great insights into the impeachment trial of Donald Trump, the second one, what the standards are. I just felt like it was timely and relevant to kind of have him on to talk about this big event in history. And so he gives us a really interesting sort of roadmap of what this trial's about and what the standards are and what the effects could be of it either way in terms of the outcome. So enjoy it. He's a really just fun guy to talk to. So it was a really fun, interesting interview. So I hope you like it. And don't forget, subscribe to the podcast if you haven't yet and tell your friends. All right, guys. Thanks. My guest this week, someone that I watch religiously, a fellow attorney. He is the host of The Beat with Ari Melber, MSNBC's chief legal correspondent, NBC News analyst, a legal analyst, and does a terrific job with sort of anything legal. Doesn't make it too wonky, but wonky enough so you really understand it. It's Ari Melber. Great to have you on the show, Ari.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, I'm a big fan of your use of song lyrics, particularly the Biggie quotes lyrics. It really helps bring things home a little bit.
Well, thank you. Sometimes it applies, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to talk about for the listeners, just kind of get them sort of up to speed. I think there may be some misconceptions about the impeachment trial and vis-a-vis a regular trial. And something that you said impeachment's not about the past, but about the future, and that the framers put it in there to protect the republic, preserve the constitution. It's not a criminal presentation per se. Explain to folks, so what is the standard, quote unquote, or the burden of proof in a trial like this?
Unlike a criminal trial where there's a very high bar of criminality that a jury finds beyond a reasonable doubt, which we know from Law and Order is like, okay, that's unanimous and, any reasonable doubt could get you off the hook. This is more of an accountability process where you need 2/3 of the Senate to convict, to say there was evidence that a high crime was committed in office. And high crimes have been generally understood to relate to abusing the powers of office rather than, say, just any old other random thing. And impeachment and conviction is not specific to the president. It's something the founders put in for federal offices because they were worried about abuse of power, which we all know from Shakespeare to any House of Cards Netflix show to any other movie. We all know about that, and it's tempting. Power's tempting. So one of the remedies is that you could bar a person from holding that office again. So they've done that, for example, with judges who were convicted of taking bribes, which is tempting. You're already a judge, so you might think, well, how much trouble could you really get in? You're in charge of this process, and right. somebody sends a little money your way. Right. If you do that and you get convicted of it, not only do you lose your job, right? You're not going to jail yet. You're just losing your job. A lot of people lose their jobs for less than that. You can lose your job just because the company makes a change. Judges lose their job that way. And then there's the question of, could you ever be rehired? And the framers had the specific penalty of saying that as a separate vote, they could also bar you from ever having that job again if your abuse was that bad. That's true for judges. It's true for the president. And we're living through a wild time where I'm not talking about what you think of Donald Trump as a person or his policies. I'm just talking about the single fact that you had a president lose an election and then openly try to steal the results and turn this country into a dictatorship and then summon people to Washington who then marched on the Capitol in a violent attack where 5 people died and they openly said they wanted to kill elected officials. Mm-hmm. If people don't think that that's worth reckoning with, then I don't know what is. And I don't say that to prejudge former President Trump's guilt. You got to go through the evidence and see whether you think he directly caused that. That's the standard, or whether all that stuff just sort of happened around him.
Right. And if you were one of the impeachment managers, what do you feel is the strongest part of this case? I mean, obviously, from an outsider looking in, you go, this should be a slam dunk. Leaving politics aside for a minute, because we just had that at the time we're recording this, we just had a 55-45 vote where 45 senators just wanted to do away with this trial based on process. What is the strongest part of the case, and how probative is it that we have people on tape saying, Trump sent us, he told us to come here?
Yeah, I think the strongest evidence is that these were Trump fans directly summoned to Washington by him, who then were told to march on the Capitol. On the spectrum of random people claim they support Paul, but you don't know them, or you met them once, but they said, we're here because of Paul. And you said, well, hold on, I didn't tell you to do that. Right? From that end of the spectrum to people only came to Washington because of Trump's invitation. Then he met up with them to reaffirm the fact that these were his people, and they met up with him to feel that he was their leader. And then they went and did this stuff. That's a very strong nexus, to use a $4 legal word. Now there's still an evidentiary question about how do you really prove, because that it can't just be conjecture, that the president directly incited it. And I could brainstorm evidence with you that cuts both ways. If you found new evidence that before that day, he discussed the idea that these people should go physically breach the Capitol and attack members of Congress because that could help him win that vote, that would be evidence against him. Conversely, if you brainstorm hypothetical evidence that shows that morning, he called someone and said, you know, this is getting a little out of hand. I want to rattle everyone. I want to have a big, big show, but we don't want them to hurt anybody.
Right.
That might go to, hypothetically, evidence supporting the idea that this was a show and it maybe was dramatic and it was anti-democratic by definition, but that it was not directly intended to cause violence. And we want to get this right as a society because it's not about the politician.
Right.
If you're going to go to the level of holding people accountable for these kind of acts, you want to make sure that you're using a fair standard to link them. Otherwise, you could go down this road where you say, oh, any member of Congress who says anything that you don't like and then somebody did something, well, now we're just going to lump them in and throw them out. And that's not a good system.
Right. And here's a case where social media hurt instead of potentially helps Donald Trump, because these people were so excited about this and I guess felt so emboldened that they were recording everything, which is great evidence and building a great case for the FBI and for the impeachment managers. But so you have actions leading up to it. You have his statements at the rally. You have the actions and then statements during and post. You know, they have in real time people. He says, we're going to go down to the Capitol. We're going to, and then you hear people on a recording, a video recording saying, yeah, we're going to go down to the like, so they're acknowledging. It seems so strong to me. And if you leave the politics aside, which is, you know, a big exception here for a second, but we'll side that off to the side for a minute. Those are the strongest building blocks. No, is making those connections between sort of some of his actions prior to, including his attempt to possibly remove the acting attorney general and put in Clark, right up until his statements. Is that the strongest line of argument here?
Well, I think what I'm going to be watching for in the trial is how much do the Democrats make it about just that day and, oh, he said this and then they marched, and how much do they widen out to what you're pointing out, which is one terrible day if the defense wants to argue was just this sort of aberrant thing. It got out of hand. Who could have seen this coming? That kind of stuff. The wider argument, of course, is critical. January 6th is the day that in Trump's mind was the time to override the results and somehow retake the presidency, end American democracy, become a dictator. And that the level of private lobbying he did suggest this was very real. This was not one more little showpiece. This was privately trying to get Georgia to flip, privately thinking, well, let's have Mike Pence do it. And everyone has to remember, the thinking there is not that this would be a very legitimate way to do it. Mm-hmm. The thinking is that you would create enough ruckus that imagine a world where Pence simply did what Trump was demanding, where he stood up there in that ceremonial role and claimed, like in some tin pot dictatorship, that actually, because of fraud and because of this vote, he was ruling that Trump was still president. And imagine doing that against the backdrop of these people that were threatening everyone and trying to kill people and left five dead, and that would be the moment where that would be the headline. The country would go into some constitutional crisis. Trump would come out and say, well, it's over. I'm still president, and dare the system to then deal with that. That is basically why, if you're making the, to your question, if you're making the argument, that's why a wider lens may help people better understand how serious this was. Because as damning as those videos were and the horrific conduct there, from a impeachment and trial perspective, what's far more damning is how orchestrated Donald Trump's efforts were, that this was a piece of that larger effort, and that's why they can argue he's more culpable.
Yeah. Would you have liked to have seen, I understand the arguments on both sides, but would you have liked to have seen the articles of impeachment a bit broader? They mentioned January, it mentions January 6th, it mentions Trump's false claims of election fraud, it mentions the Georgia call to the Georgia Secretary of State. Or would that sort of gotten bogged down in sort of politics in the House?
Well, historically, there's two ways to write these. You can write them narrowly to argue that it's very targeted and reasonable. The Republicans argued that's how they approached Clinton. They felt or they viewed it as a lot of stuff that he did, but they focused. I mean, the Starr report was very long, for example, but they focused on things they thought were more obstructive about lying and obstruction and just try to do it narrow. Mm-hmm. If you look back at the Nixon draft, which did not ultimately have to get passed because he resigned, but the draft was quite broad. It was like, this guy's got an enemies list. He's got a dirty tricks operation. He's got obstruction. It was like everything.
Right. He has a parking ticket from 1962.
Yeah, and he's a bad tipper. And then Johnson, which people don't think about that much, but Andrew Johnson, which was in also like Trump in the crucible of debates over racism and how the government could run under rule of law. The Johnson thing started ostensibly about something small and whether he had the authority to control a cabinet secretary or not. But then what they wrote was like, it was like over 10 articles and it just listed everything. And it was like, we hate him, whatever. And that was the one that came closest to conviction. It was one vote shy of conviction in the Senate, which is a reminder that, you know, these things can still happen. It can take on a life of its own. But I think with Donald Trump, having been impeached before and the nature of this, if you're asking me substantively, I think that it would be important to have the clearest record possible with everything that is at a constitutional level a potential high crime. And I think they went more narrowly and they were also rushed. And the last thing I'll say at the risk of repeating myself is I don't think it's fully sunk into everyone because of all the reasons we know. We've all lived through this. We know how there's Trump exhaustion and people want to turn the page and he's so flamboyant and some of what he says is not true, but then other times he confesses in public, all that stuff. I don't think it's fully sunk in. That he was dead serious about turning this country into a dictatorship. Yeah. Even when I say those words, to some ears, it may sound extreme, but it's what he was publicly doing. And that's the crucible and the context to me for January 6th.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I had a conversation with somebody the other day and they said, hey, there's a website, all the people from Parler, they've kind of gravitated to this other site and they want to have content. Maybe you could make some money and do some content. I'm like, I'm not doing content for these people. They're insurrectionists and they're not going to like what I have to say. I said to the guy, and so we're going back and forth. And then he goes, and then I mentioned Pelosi and he goes, well, you know, they're all the same. I go, no. I go, you don't get to say that here. You don't get to say Pelosi's bill about healthcare is on a equivalent plane with trying to turn this country into a dictatorship. And you're spot on. Like people just, I don't know. I'm really worried personally because after this 55-45 vote, he's not going to get convicted. So what does this say? There's another young Trump in the wings. I'll say it, probably Hawley. What happens to this country, in your opinion, because I don't see him getting convicted.
Right. Well, I don't know if he's going to get convicted or not, because I think we have to just see what happens. But I take your point. Mm-hmm. The wider concern you raise is, remember when everyone was like, oh, 2021 is going to be so different?
Right.
Yeah. Like people, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I get it. We feel like we want to find a reason to turn the page, but like the calendar doesn't make things automatically better. Mm-hmm. And while the election ends Trump, it clearly hasn't ended Trumpism. And so I think it's important as a society that we take a breath and take stock, figure out where you want to do accountability and where you want to move forward, and remember that we don't have to function that way. So that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, to the deeper point you raise, there's no reason to think that the forces of racism that exist but have been reignited, and the clear comfort or support for an autocratic attack on democracy, which of course relates to the racism because there's evidence that some people are looking at where elections are going and they see both their party and to some degree the type of people they want to be in charge not being able to win in that system. So those are interlocking forces, which I'm not saying anything all that novel here. This is a theme in many countries that have had real tension as the composition of the country changed and democracy became more controversial for more people because they felt they were on the wrong side of it. Mm. So those are like really big structural things that we're going to have to navigate that I don't think just quote unquote go away. Yeah. And for folks, for your listeners who want to go deeper than a podcast, I mean, is there anything deeper than a podcast?
No.
Is it a big question? No. But one of the better pieces on this, and I, you know, probably have to read too much about all this stuff, is I highly recommend the historian Timothy Snyder, who wrote a piece about how post-truth is pre-fascist. And he's not some Trump-hating wacko. He's a historian who has devoted his public life and career to understanding these kind of dictatorial threats in multiple countries. And he uses that frame to look at what the threats are now. And there's a version of it that ran in the New York Times Magazine. People can just Google Timothy Snyder, probably fascism. Always a fun word to put in your Google.
Exactly. Is that the Gamers and Breakers article? He just did a piece of it. Yeah, it's really great. Yeah, I mentioned him before on the show. Yeah, he's got such a great perspective, and he doesn't feel overly biased. He just is like, he feels like he's just talking facts here, you know, to get us up to speed on things. But I highly recommend it. But The Beat with Ari Melber is 6 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC, and he's doing a lot of great work specifically on the coverage of the trial, the impeachment trial. And really enjoyed your show last night, too, by the way, the different areas you were covering. So anyway, it's great to have you on, and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Absolutely. Let's do it. Thank you.
There you go, Ari Melber. I want to have him on again. There's so much stuff going on to talk about, especially on the legal side of things. But hope you enjoyed it, and hope you guys have a great week, and we'll see you next week, everybody.